has had a long dream. And as you study into the various periods of European history, and you connect that with what we understand from Bible prophecy, this concept of a long dream goes even further back than really even the dark forests of Europe in the period of the Dark Ages and the Roman periods. It even goes further than that. It actually goes back to an event that is connected with this gentleman here from this picture, a familiar picture from our past, Nebuchadnezzar II, the king of Babylon, the subject of the book of Daniel, the one with whom Daniel interacted on a very close basis, as we know the story of Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar II, the king of Babylon, who took Babylon to its peak in terms of a world power and the opulence of a city, and then was described by Daniel in chapter 2 as the head of the gold, head of gold, of the image that Nebuchadnezzar had this dream about, as the story of Daniel opens up and we begin to have all these fantastic images and ideas of Babylon, of Persia, of Greece and Rome, and these systems that were to evolve, beginning with Rome, or Babylon, and that period of time as it is set in the prophetic flow, and as Daniel, as God's servant, interacted with this great empire, this great king, as it had come in contact with the nation, the people of God. But we're going to jump to chapter 4 of the book of Daniel. And it is in chapter 4 that Nebuchadnezzar had another one of his dreams. You have to wonder what Nebuchadnezzar would eat at night when he would retire. He was probably scarfing down pepperoni pizza because he had some really fantastic dreams. Either that or he was taking a half a bottle of melatonin at a time to get off to sleep, because he kept having these dreams. We know what the source was. Unfortunately, he had an interpreter like Daniel to come in and tell him what they meant. But in chapter 4 of the book of Daniel, we can turn there very quickly, and I just want to point out this dream that Nebuchadnezzar had in Daniel, the 4th chapter, that was unique in terms of the story of this long dream. And it is another dream that he said that he had, beginning in verse 4 of chapter 4. He said, I had a dream that frightened me, and I saw visions that terrified me as I lay in my bed. And so he issued a call again for his magicians to interpret, which they had difficulty doing. And he finally wound up with Belteshazzar, or Daniel, to come in and tell him what exactly it was that he was seeing. And he begins to describe it. In verse 10, he said, "While I was laying in my bed, this is what I dreamed. I saw a large tree in the middle of the earth, and the tree grew very tall." Now, Daniel is later going to tell Nebuchadnezzar that you are that tree. So this tree represents Nebuchadnezzar as that head of gold, and of course the empire of Babylon. "The tree grew very tall and strong, reaching high into the heavens for all the world to see. It had fresh green leaves, and it was loaded with fruit for all to eat. Wild animals lived in its shade, and birds nested in its branches. All the world was fed from this tree." Interesting statement. All the world was fed from this tree. Again, this was the head of gold. And the gold is the finest of the metals represented in that image of Daniel chapter 2. The head is what gives the direction to the image and to the body. The impact of Babylon for all the other systems that arose, Persia, Greece, Rome, and all the various revivals of the Roman system down to the very final one, which the Bible describes as by the name of Babylon, again, connects us back to the origins of this system as it was brought together in the city at its height under Nebuchadnezzar, and as God designated it as such when it came into contact with his people in the way that it did, and Daniel witnessing as he did to, if you will, the beast. Because that's essentially what Daniel did. He was the first witness, if we could use that term, to interact and deal directly with the beast in this person of Nebuchadnezzar as the embodiment of that system that has had many different evolutions and revivals down through the years. And so when it says here that all the world is fed from this tree, we can understand that in terms of a spiritual, a cultural, a political, and an economic manner, indeed the world has been fed spiritually and all from that tree of Babylon. And again, that's why that is the system that really arches from the book of Genesis with the Tower of Babel and Nimrod all the way to the book of Revelation. It is this one system called Babylon in its various forms that we find consistently from the beginning to the end as the system that stands in opposition to God, His purposes, His people, and His plan. And again, that's why that system of Babylon is so important. And the statement that it was a tree that fed, that all the world fed from this tree, again, helps us to understand. Really, a good history that such as what Will Durant wrote in his Story of Civilization in his multi-volume set. If you ever have a chance to look at that, just read up on what it says about Babylon at its height. And those few pages and his description will give you a good deal of background as to the cultural, spiritual, political importance of Babylon to really the world down through the years. We talk a lot about the Greco-Roman heritage of the West, but it really... so much of it did begin in Babylon, and the parallels to prophecy through the historical fulfillment are quite fascinating. And it's you then understand why God chose Babylon as the system throughout the Bible that stands in opposition to His plan. And the world indeed has fed from that tree in so many different ways. But what is interesting to note, and where we want to go, is down in verse 13 and 14, where he said, "As I was lay dreaming, a messenger and a holy one coming down from heaven, and the messenger shouted, 'Cut down the tree, and lop off its branches, shake off its leaves, and scatter its fruit, chase the wild animals from its shade and the birds from its branches. But,' in verse 15, 'leave the stump and the roots in the ground, bound with a band of iron and bronze, and surrounded by tender grass. Now let him be drenched with the dew of heaven, and let him live with the wild animals among the plants of the field.'" So in verse 15, we really have a synopsis of what so much of this dream really was to tell. That this tree, which is identified as Nebuchadnezzar, was chopped down. But it was to be bound over with a band of iron and bronze and surrounded by tender grass. And this picture illustrates, as it does here, the band of iron on this stump that is of the tree that has been cut down. And if you understand anything about trees and shrubs of that size, that you can cut the tree down, but the root system is still there, and there's still life there. And by encompassing it with this band of bronze and iron, that life is in a sense shut off, and it's inhibited for a period of time. Now this chapter goes on to talk about Nebuchadnezzar being like a beast of the field as he boasted of his accomplishments and was filled with his pride. Daniel foretold that if he did that, he would be cut down as well in a literal sense, and he was. And that was a type of, as seven times were to pass over, seven times being seven prophetical years of 360 days each. You come up with 2,520 years from a prophetic sense, which we have always understood and timed from the fall of Babylon forward into the future. And this system was to be cut down, but it was its growth, in a sense, was to be controlled or inhibited. Now, the life was still there, and it had its various manifestations through the other empires from a cultural and spiritual point of view, but Babylon itself was forestalled. It was cut off. And with that, that happened exactly according to the prophecy. Because when you look further here in chapter 4, you see what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. He walked along the walls one night, started to boast about what he was, what he had done, and God cursed him, cut him down. And this is what he looked like. Or this may be what you look like by the end of a full day of prophecy seminars. I don't know. Whichever will come from that. But this was the English artist William Blake's portrayal of Nebuchadnezzar's 7 years of insanity, which is a rather striking picture. The kids always get a kick out of this whenever I show this picture in various locations on the circuit. And but this is to kind of show what Nebuchadnezzar looked like during this period of time, as he ate the grass of the field as the animals did, and was in this period of insanity, which the histories talk about and give us an indication as to what took place. So that was a type of that system being inhibited and being cut down, but the roots, the life of the roots, were held off by that band of iron. Now, we understand from our understanding of prophecy, and have taught this for many years, that Babylon fell, gave rise to Persia, the Persian Empire, who in turn fell to Alexander the Great, the Greek Empire, and it had its divisions after Alexander's death. And then ultimately Rome came on the scene, and the empire of iron, and the toes and the feet of iron there from Daniel chapter 2, and this great beast system came on. And Rome itself has had a number of different revivals. And this is another picture from our past, again, that gives a pretty good indication of this idea of seven heads and ten horns of the various revivals, with a woman up here at the very top. And you see the woman riding the beast. And, of course, the seven heads and the ten horns illustrate the prophecy of Revelation. And we have understood that this represents the various revivals of these systems, and particularly the Roman system from the time of the heads represent Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome, and then the horns, the various revivals of this system down through the history to the time of the end. And we are looking and waiting for this last horn, the tenth horn, to revive, as Mr. Rhodes was mentioning in his presentation just a minute ago. We are looking for that last horn to be revived in a final configuration that is again called Babylon the Great from Revelation chapter 17 and particularly chapter 18 of Revelation. We look yet for that. To understand how that might take place and from where it's going to come and what its form and system will be, again, we go to the Bible. We understand what we do from Daniel, from Revelation especially, from other prophecies. But we also have understood this as we've overlain it to history and the historical record and understood what that is telling us as we've looked at the various empires that have come and gone down through the years, especially since the fall with Rome and its various revivals after the fall of Rome in 476 AD. And as we've looked at the history of Europe and its interconnection with the Roman Church and various other nations during those periods of time, we have learned a great deal. And it is to that system that we continue to look for this final revival of this particular system. Now, what I want to do at this point is digress off on a parallel track and take you to the modern nation of Germany and take you on a little trip that I had a chance to make last September, when I went over to Germany and spent about 10 days with Paul Kiefer, and he was gracious enough to give me a chunk of his time and his translation expertise and knowledge of Germany, and we made a trip to Berlin and a couple of other locations. But on the last day that I was in Germany, we made a trip right over here to this little spot where you see this yellow circle, which is on the Belgium border in west on the western border of Germany. About a 40-minute drive from where Mr. Kiefer lives is the city of Aachen, A-A-C-H-E-N. Now, Aachen is a very interesting city in terms of European history, even Europe today, the European Union and the countries that are involved in that system and what it is doing. It's a fascinating city. I read about it a number of years ago and understood certain things, and I wanted to go see it. And interestingly, Mr. Kiefer had never been there himself in all his years of service in Germany, and so I helped along his knowledge of Germany and German culture at that time as we took the day and made a trip over to the city of Aachen. It was in Aachen that this particular man made a name for himself and put that city on the map. This is a gold bust of Charlemagne. Or if you are in Germany and you refer to him as Charlemagne, you might be corrected and be told that his name is Karl de Grosse. Charlemagne is the French version of this gentleman's name, Karl the Great, Charles the Great, who was a German king who united the tribes of Germany in let's say from about 750 AD on to, I think he died in 814. We're talking about the 8th century when Charlemagne rose to power and united the very different tribes, German-speaking tribes of Europe, into a system that became Europe. You may be familiar with this picture, having seen it from any number of publications or books. You go into the treasury in the city of Aachen, there near the cathedral, and this plus many other relics are there. They tell you that right up here in the crown, there's a piece of a bone from Charlemagne's body, and I'm sure that it's true, because Charlemagne was made a saint years after his death, and is worshipped in a sense as Saint Charles to this day. But he was a unique person at a unique period of time in history. Now we look at Charlemagne and what he did as one of the revivals of, or one of the horns of these 10 horns of the beast that I showed you the picture of earlier there from Revelation. What he did was bring together these various tribes, and he ruled over a part of Europe that was larger than anything that had been ruled over since the time of Constantine. Constantine being the Christian emperor who in the 4th century legitimized Christianity and still held things together at that particular point in the period of the Roman Empire. But Charlemagne's empire was the greatest since the time of Constantine. What is interesting to note, what we must realize about this man's setting and his time period is interesting. This was the 700s, the latter part of the 8th century. Charlemagne had a father whose name was Pepin the Great. Pepin's father was a man named Charles Martel. Charles Martel, or Charles the Hammer, defeated the Muslims in the year 732 at a very famous battle, the Battle of Tours. What was taking place in 732 was the Muslims were on the advance out of the Arabian Peninsula. The Prophet Muhammad had died in the year 632. And within a 100-year period, the Muslim faith, under the sword of Islam, had spread out of Arabia, throughout the Middle East, across North Africa. They had leapt across the Mediterranean. They had taken over what we call Spain and the Iberian Peninsula. And they pushed over the Pyrenees, and they were into what we call France today. And there, at a place called Tours, Charlemagne's grandfather, Charles Martel, raised an army and defeated the Muslim armies in the year 732. If you want to look at it this way, perhaps this was the first push of the peoples out of that region of the Middle East into Europe, wasn't even called Europe at that time, but in a sense, it was the first push. Now, through the ensuing centuries, the Muslims made additional forays into Europe, and they were at least twice defeated. The last time, I believe, in the 17th century, they were defeated at the gates of Vienna. When the retreating Turks went back to their homes, they left behind great bags of this little bean. And they found the Europeans found these beans, and they found that when they were roasted and ground up, they made a delicious drink called coffee. And that is part of the story of how coffee was introduced into Europe as a result of the defeat of the Muslims in the 17th century at Vienna. But over the centuries, they made additional efforts to conquer Europe. They were not successful. So in a sense, what we look at in Daniel chapter 11, verse 40, in terms of this king of the south pushing at the king of the north, at least in some ways, the attempts have already been made, not to fulfill that prophecy as it will in the future, but when you look at the advance of the Muslim armies out of that area, and the first one being in 732, we see this continual friction going on. And there's quite a bit of interesting history with Charlemagne and the Muslims even during that time and how they look at it in terms of history. But Pepin succeeded his father, Charles Martel. Pepin died, and Charlemagne took over, and he expanded the empire that his father and grandfather had developed. And this map here shows in the dark regions, essentially the extent of Charlemagne's empire overlaid over what is modern Europe. You see the dark spots here, and this is the area of Germany, France, Belgium, Luxembourg, Netherlands, up in through here. The empire went down just to the Pyrenees. It really never, Charlemagne never pushed the Muslims out of Spain. He had one foray down into this area, but he was defeated, and he had to retreat back across the mountains, and he never tried to push any further down there himself. But Charlemagne's empire and his influence extended down into most of present-day Italy and this part of this core central area of Europe today. Now, What is interesting to note as well is Charlemagne's connection with the papacy in Rome at this period of time. When Charlemagne was a youth and his father Pepin was still on the throne, Pope Stephen, who was in Rome, made a trip across the mountains into modern-day Germany, seeking the help of Pepin in his to shore up his role as the pope, which Stephen helped him to do. And that essentially took place, and it's really set a pattern in this interesting relationship down through the Middle Ages of the church and the state, and the various ups and downs and the frictions and the politics and the ins and outs that down through the years have been a hallmark of the story in Europe between church and state. It really kind of coalesced with Pope Stephen III and Charlemagne's father Pepin, so that when Charlemagne became the king and he consolidated his rule, he defeated a number of these various tribes and brought them together into a system. He was a natural ally for the next pope in Rome, who was Pope Leo III. Pope Leo III, again, had to appeal to Charlemagne to help him, help for Charlemagne's help, because Charlemagne had the army. And Leo III had certain problems in again, establishing his papacy in Rome. And he eventually invited Charlemagne to come down and to help him out, which Charlemagne did. Charlemagne was a very devout man. And he came down, and on Christmas Day in the year 800 A.D., Leo III, the Pope, crowned Charlemagne emperor of Europe in St. Peter's in Rome. And that marks a very significant event in history and in this whole story of Europe's long dream. Charlemagne said he didn't expect it. The historians debate whether or not that's true. The fact is that he was crowned by the Pope. The Pope placed a crown on his head, declared him emperor, and it legitimized what was already in a de facto state of Charlemagne being the political leader of this entire region, and now, in a sense, in a relationship, an alliance with the spiritual head of the church, the Pope, and the power, the influence, and the mission of these two men, and particularly Charlemagne, then began to grow and to develop. Charlemagne looked upon himself as a very devout man. If you go to Aachen today, you go right into the city center, and you see this statue. This is a replica of one that's several locations within the city. And Charlemagne is holding in his hand here a globe in his left hand and a cross in his right hand, symbolizing once again the idea of Christianity or the church over the world. And then he's got a crown with a cross on his head right here, and it's a typical picture of Charlemagne. This stands right out in front. This large building behind him is the town hall, but it's built on the site and incorporates much of what Charlemagne built as his palace in the city of Aachen. And that much of it still remains. You can take a tour of that. We did. It has a large hall on the second level and has government offices throughout this. And it also on the, I believe it would be the west end of this hall, has part of the original palace still intact and as part of that part of the building. But this was essentially his palace and his site within the city of Aachen where he established his capital. Charlemagne was a very spiritual person. He was also a warrior king. But when I say spiritual and warrior, I'm not saying that he was a righteous, devout man by the terms by the definition that we would use. There's a story of Charlemagne on one of his expeditions to subdue a rebellion of one of the Germanic tribes that he marched days on end with his army, and he encountered the rebels, and he defeated them, and they actually surrendered to him, but because of his anger and his wrath that they would defy his authority, it is said that he lined up 1,000 of their chief men, and he cut their heads off, slaughtered them right on the spot. And then from that site, he marched about 10 days to a major church and celebrated Christmas. But that was the times. Those were the men. Those were the type of men that forged these types of empires. And yet they considered themselves devout. Charlemagne considered himself a defender of the faith. With the Pope, he felt his duty was to spread Christianity throughout his regions and his lands and to enforce the rule and the realm of Christianity. And he looked upon himself in that way as a defender of the church. And the church was certainly glad to have his assistance in doing so. This is another view of the front side of that palace of Charlemagne. And if you will look, this is an interesting picture. As you would go into the front door, up the steps and into the door of this palace, you go under these statues. Now, what you have here is a very interesting representation. This is Jesus Christ, pictured here, seated on a throne in the center. And again, Christ is holding a globe that is surmounted by the cross, again, showing the dominance of Christianity over the world. And he's making a kind of a peace sign with his right hand. But kneeling in front of him are two other figures. On his left, to your right, this is Charlemagne, wearing his crown. He's got a sword right here, and a symbol of his authority and power. And to the right of the statue of Christ is an image, a statue of Pope Leo III. So in this, you've got a picture of state and church under Jesus Christ, sitting on a throne. The image portrayed so many ways and different expressions in art throughout not only Europe, but especially down in Italy as well. The idea of Christ sitting on his throne, on an earthly throne, through the church, ruling through the two halves of the church, of the political state matter and the spiritual realm. The idea pictured here is the idea that the kingdom of God is on the earth, in the position of the church and the state. And this is an idea that did not begin with Charlemagne. It took a unique form in his reign. It actually began a few hundred years earlier, during the 4th century, and the battles that took place there with the legitimization of Christianity within the Roman Empire, but particularly in the writings of the great church father, Augustine. Augustine of Hippo, this very famous church father, wrote a book called The City of God. And in the City of God, Augustine put forth the idea that essentially ripped out all the literal teaching that you and I take from the scriptures of the kingdom of God coming to this earth and a literal 1,000-year reign of Jesus Christ on the earth. When we read, as we do every year at the Feast of Tabernacles, Revelation 20, and we talk about the millennium, and we talk about saints reigning and ruling with Christ on the earth, we understand that and believe that to the depth of our being as being literal. That is going to happen. That's what we look forward to. And of course, many Christians from the time of Christ down through the first few hundred years, they believe that as well. But as Christ did not come, as persecution took its toll within the church, and as the state wore on, and eventually then the church became, the Gentile church became legitimized and became the official religion of the Roman Empire, then you had to, what do you do with this idea that Christ is going to return and subdue all earthly kingdoms? Well, Augustine was the formulator of the idea that that's symbolism. That's not literal. And he did that in this book, one of the great books of the Western world called the City of God. And his idea was that the church now has taken that position, and the church on the earth, along with the state, is doing the work of God. The Pope is the vicar of Christ, and the political leader, in a sense, works with him, and together they represent the kingdom of God on the earth. Now, we can look at history, and we can see the fruits of that idea. So I don't need to go into all of that today. That has probably, among the ideas that man has generated, has caused more suffering among mankind than any other idea. The idea that the church is the kingdom of God on the earth to this day. But that's symbolized in this right here. Now, what's interesting about that book, The City of God, is that Charlemagne, it was his favorite book. It was his bedtime reading. He was an illiterate man. He could barely write his name. You go through Aachen today and you see symbols of kind of the city symbol is his autograph. But he read this book, and his teachers taught it to him, and he believed that his mission, his goal in life, was to carry this out. What he created in Europe was called and became called Europe was a spiritual and a cultural entity that gave birth and breath and life to a system that was a revival and has carried on down to this day. That is why Charlemagne is revered so much as he is, as in a sense, the father of Europe. The city fathers of this city of Aachen every year They give out a prize called the Charlemagne Prize. And they've given it to Tony Blair, Bill Clinton. President Clinton has received it. Pope John Paul II was a recipient of this prize. A former Secretary of State George Marshall back in the 1950s. But they give it every year to one person whom they figure to have done the most in that year to further the cause of Europe. They call it the Charlemagne Prize. London's Economist magazine comes out every week. They have a column every week about Europe and the political, cultural affairs of Europe, and it's called Charlemagne, just to show you the impact of this man's ideas, what he did there in the 8th century, and how it has endured and has embodied the idea of Europe to this very day. Next to Charlemagne's palace is the church that Charlemagne built. This is the cathedral, and it's about 100 yards to the south of the palace, and it slopes down this courtyard. It's very interesting. Charlemagne built his palace, his seat of government, on higher ground. When he built his church, it was on lower ground. I wonder if there's some symbolism to that, but when you stand in the middle of this courtyard, you're looking up to the palace, and you're looking down to the church. But this round octagonal part of the church was the original church, part of the church that Charlemagne built. It's been added on to over the centuries, but this is the original part of it. You could go into it, in one of the naves, the main nave, is this giant gold sarcophagus that holds the remains of Charlemagne. When Charlemagne died in about 814, they sat him on a chair and sealed him up in a tomb. He was sitting in a chair holding a cross and a sword, and he stayed there for several hundred years. And one of the Holy Roman emperors, I think it was Otto III, wanted to see what he looked like, and they opened the tomb up years later, and he was still sitting there. Of course, you know, he didn't look quite in his birthday suit and anything like that, but he was still sitting there, and they gathered up all of his bones, and most of them were put in this gold sarcophagus, which is quite ornate, and sits there in the middle of the main nave. This is the view of the original part of the chapel, an octagonal shaped dome. If you can see this right here, this is Jesus Christ pictured here sitting again on a throne with the sun around his head. And it's a rather interesting spot. This is the original church that he built, and there's a large chandelier that's coming down here. This line represents a chain that's running down to a large chandelier that's down in here. And you can go up into the balcony off of that center area. And this is the throne of Charlemagne. This is a seat upon which a majority of the Holy Roman emperors down through the years were crowned. And this is not normally open to the public. You have to buy a special guided tour to be able to get into the balcony where you can see this. They tell you that this these marble slabs that make up this throne came from the area of Palestine, but it's an ancient throne. Charlemagne was not crowned on this. Remember, he was crowned in Rome. But subsequent emperors of the Holy Roman Empire were crowned on this particular throne. What is interesting, and I was doing some reading a few years ago, and it was talking about this cathedral. First of all, the original foundation stones of this cathedral of Charlemagne were built on the site of an ancient pagan temple. And the configuration of that temple, they found, as they have studied it and dug it up over the years, the foundation of this church, of the original part, is on a pagan temple whose configuration is the same as Stonehenge in England. If you remember the round stones that are obelisk-like that are setting up in the plains of England there, it has the same type of a pattern. A few years ago, there was a photographer in this chapel in one day taking pictures. This was back probably 10 or 15 years ago. And he was there on the day of the summer solstice, the longest day of the year. And he was there at the point where in the midday, and he noticed a phenomenon take place. The sun, when it reached its highest point in the sky, came through the upper windows of this original chapel, and it hit a gold orb at the bottom of that chandelier that I showed you, and the rays went directly to this throne. And that happened on the day of the summer solstice. Nobody seemed to know that would happen, and he just discovered it, and I read about it in a book recently, which is very interesting. We could talk a whole other subject about the symbolism of that and the way so many of these churches and temples, how they were aligned with the sun. But even to this day, there's an interesting phenomenon that takes place as the sun hits the rays of that throne on the longest day of the year when the sun is shining there. So it's a fascinating spot and place to tour. This is a replica of the crown of the Holy Roman Emperors. It's only a replica. The original is in the treasury in Vienna to this day. And you could go there and you can see it. Again, you've got a picture of a cross and an arch going over this, which again symbolizes Christianity ruling over with the political power ruling over the world. But this is a picture of that. When Napoleon was about to have himself crowned, he made a pilgrimage to Aachen. And this is a representation of that, as he wanted to see the throne of Charlemagne, or at least of the Holy Roman Emperors. Napoleon was not crowned on this throne. He was crowned in Paris. And the story is that he took the crown himself from the hand of the Pope and put it on his own head. He didn't need to be crowned by any spiritual leader himself. So but he did make this trip to Aachen to visit the Cathedral of Charlemagne and pay homage to this great man in European history. As this man, another revival of that Roman system, took his place among the revivals and did what he did within Europe. So it's a fascinating place, fascinating story. To give a background to exactly what it is we are looking for in this quest of Europe and its long dream. Charlemagne brought things together in a way that helped to further that dream. Now, today we, as Mr. Rhodes is bringing out in his presentation, we have a matter of Europe coming together in a union that is now 50 years old. 27 countries. They have a currency, a very strong currency. As he said, if you go there now, you will find that you will be shelling out more dollars for the euro as it has gained in recent years against the dollar. The dollar is still the American or the lingua or the basic trade currency of the world. Oil is denominated in dollars. There's talk at some point that barrels of oil may be denominated in euros. I don't know when that would happen. I do know that if it happens, you and I will pay a whole lot more at the pump than we pay today. So in one sense, we don't want to see that happen, but this currency, this union, and what is taking place in Europe is growing and it is developing. Now, with all of this as a background, and with what we have understood in the church, we've got to understand and realize that Europe itself today is not quite ready for prime time. We have to be honest in that. Europe has a number of issues, a number of problems that they are facing that is keeping them from becoming this system, this final revival of this system that we have long talked about, looked for from a prophetic point of view, and that we feel the pages of the Bible give us an insight into. They are a long way from any of that taking place. It just hasn't happened. And they're not ready at this point. They, a year and nearly 2 years ago, they rejected the Constitution that they had worked so long to put together. They did not ratify that. Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, who is the president of the rotating president of the EU right now, says she wants to revive that between now and the end of June and is making that more the centerpiece of her presidency. How far she will get is yet to be determined as to even whether that particular constitution becomes the governing charter of a future Europe is another big question. They left out any reference in that constitution to Christianity, to the church. That created a great deal of concern in the Vatican and a great deal of comment. But because Europe is a very secular system, or the nations of Europe are very secular today. They call it a post-Christian society in Europe. Church attendance is very, very insignificant. The church does not play, in one sense, that strong a role today. The current Pope, Benedict the 16th, has recognized that. One of the reasons, perhaps the reason, he chose the name Benedict, which is named after the patron saint of Europe, a 7th century monk who is the patron saint of Europe. He chose that name in large part to help fulfill a mission that he feels is his to re-energize the spiritual condition of Europe. So Benedict XVI has talked a great deal about that. And again, that's something that needs to be done. Europe faces other problems. They have a demographic problem. Their populations are in decline. In fact, nations such as Italy and Spain, they are not reproducing themselves. You go to certain parts of northern villages and towns in northern Italy, you don't see many children on the streets and in the schools because they're not having children. Germany is the same way. In France, they say that the most popular name for newborn children in the last couple of years is Mohammed. It's not Pierre, because of the Muslim immigrants, and they are outpopulating the native French. In Holland, they are moving out. The Dutch are moving out in droves because, again, of the tensions that have been created because of the Muslim immigrations. These are just a few of a number of issues and a number of problems that are taking place within Europe that's keeping it from fulfilling what, frankly, we have said in the church for so long is going to take place. What could turn it around? Mr. Rhodes mentioned a number of different things. Another major terrorist threat could turn things around and cause other repercussions, leading to perhaps a spiritual revival or the idea of someone with some leader with certain strengths to rally the people, to essentially tell them that you need to move out of your parents' home. You need to start changing diapers, and you need to quit depending upon the state to socialize and to provide you for everything. In other words, pull yourself up and move yourself forward in the history and the tradition of your ancestors and to be somebody. For that leader to come along, there would have to be some major changes, a major terrorist attack in Europe larger than anything that they have seen, and perhaps even what we saw on 9/11, could begin certain things to take place. It will probably be some type of a large shock. People like the lady who wrote this book, Claire Berlinski, a year ago, called Menace in Europe, sees that within Europe today there is this possibility of a resurgence of a powerful continental-wide governmental system that could create large problems for the United States and for the rest of the world in a resurgence of pride and power. Essentially what you have today among those that watch these things, the political pundits, you have two schools of thought. There's one school of thought is that Europe is a museum. Europe is a museum. Its glory is past. It's old Europe, as Donald Rumsfeld says, or said. Then the other school of thought, represented by this lady, or we could say that she is a pretty good representative of this school of thought, Claire Berlinski, who has lived there and written a great deal about Europe, and she says that the continent's crisis is America's too, and that things could turn around and things could change, that there are within the understrata of Europe still the waves and the emotions and some of the feelings that could be brought to the fore that could see Europe led by a very powerful country, Germany, quite likely, that could do certain things that, like it did in the past, or certainly with the guise of helping the world, helping itself to rectify certain problems. One wonders if the global economy that we have and seems to be continuing to grow is going to produce yet another stage of prosperity on a global basis greater than anything that we see yet to this day. Personally, I tend to lean toward that because when you look at Revelation chapter 18, you're seeing a system, a global system there that is quite lucrative, high standard of living. It seems to be something even larger than what we have now, and we have a very high global economy. But I wonder if it's going to even take another level of development to reach what we see described there. Many things yet will have to take place to accomplish that. But in the meantime, we wonder what will be some of the catalysts for it. And a big question mark comes up. And sometimes we have to find these challenges even within ourselves as we question what we have taught as a church through the years. Should we place as much emphasis on Europe, and is this the area to look for? We believe we do because that's the tradition that we have had, and we still believe that from the scriptures. We also understand that in Revelation chapter 13, we have this picture of two beasts that rise up, and one is described as a political leader, and the other is a miracle working figure that is going to have a significant impact in this final revival of this system. that is described there. We have this amply described in our literature. I'm not going to take the time to go through it. But I want to go back to a quote that was made by John Paul II in November of 1982 when he gave a speech in Spain at a youth day. And he said to the assembled peoples, and he was appealing to Europe, the spiritual Europe of the ages, and he said to them, revive your roots. Revive your roots. And it was an electrifying statement for anyone who understood the prophecies of Daniel chapter 4, as I remember we noted so well at the time. And it was an allusion to Europe to remember its Christian roots and to revive them, because there's still life in those roots. This gentleman, Benedict XVI, has made a statement that Europe, about Europe being a cultural and a historical concept. And again, he has staked even his name that he chose and his papacy on the need to revive Europe along the lines and to keep it from sliding into another dark age. Again, Revelation 13 teaches us that there is a miracle working figure that is going to arise to accomplish that. Now, it's not going to be the first one of the pictures I mentioned here. It may not be this particular gentleman. I've long since gone past the point where I make any type of predictions there. But when you see a continuity of a theme there and you understand the prophecies, you see a pattern and you know where to look and where to come. In the last page of this book that I referred to a minute ago by Berlinski, Menace in Europe, she comes down at the end of the book and she makes a very startling statement that when I came to that conclusion, it really grabbed me. But she was talking about the various things that would have to take, that could take place to cause Europe to pull itself together and to be what, as we would say prophetically, the prophecies show that it would be, and turning around its demographics, dealing with the threat of Islamic terrorism and in its population problems there. And she says, we have no idea, the last two sentences of her book, we have no idea what these events would herald. But it's possible and reasonable to imagine a very ugly outcome. And once again, the only people to whom this will come as a surprise are those who have not been paying attention. The only people who will be surprised, she says, are those who are not paying attention. What Ms. Berlinski is saying is that those who are not watching. It's another way of saying to watch. And again, I go back to Revelation 16 and verse 15 that I concluded with this morning, where Christ said to watch. And he did so within the context of this great spiritual deception going out from the mouth of the dragon to the beast and the false prophet. And I think there's a great deal of instruction there for us to remember and to not lose sight of as we look for this long dream to once again come back to life and the roots of that whole system spring back to life and a time yet in the future that will catapult this world into events that will usher in the kingdom of God.